Today on the Grave Talks, who are we when we die? A conversation with Gare Allen. When we pass on, how much influence do we have on our current physical world? Are we able to help solve crimes? Can we right wrongs of the past? Can we influence those who need to move in a positive direction or drive those who we hate into madness? Or can we simply choose to come back as a new evolved human with past lessons under our belt, ready to live a life of heightened awareness? So many questions, so few answers. Today, we discuss all of that and more with Gare Allen on The Grave Talks.
On the street I grew up in as a young child, there was a family, and the first case in the first ghost crimes book is based on that family story. And the police were involved, and nobody would talk about what had happened. And it was only later that I understood that it was sort of being covered up in a way, because there was possession involved, there was murder involved, and there were small children, and it was a very sensitive and supernatural situation. And I think, and of course, you know, I'm 53 now, so that was back in the, you know, early 1980s. And, you know, back then, you know, the paranormal and supernatural, especially if you're an investigator or police officer or first responder, you don't want to be the spooky molder, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to say a ghost did it. It isn't, those things sure. Wasn't acceptable. It wasn't even a thing you would even consider. And there had to be an explanation, but, you know, it became unexplained or, you know, unsolved mystery sort of thing. And no one thought to look to the supernatural or didn't feel comfortable. And of course, the public wouldn't accept that, hey, it's okay that this happened, but a ghost did it. So we can't hold anybody accountable, right? The public wants accountability.
Sure.
So you can't just blame it on a ghost. And that's where I got the ear from ghost crimes. And there's a line in the first book where Detective Burke is trying to explain that these things are happening and there's a supernatural force, even though he doesn't want to believe it. Mm-hmm. There's the cases are building, and he's explaining to his partner that there's something other happening here outside of his control. And is a line where he says, people kill people. These aren't ghost crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and then later in life, you know, now that, you know, 2022, and,
yeah,
you know, going into 2023, good Lord, you know, anything's possible now. And so when I did research, I realized that police cases are, there's no real format for every state. They differ, but when they write them, the numbers correlate to the state, the city, the county, the type of crime, and there's actually a code for paranormal or supernatural.
Really?
To be out under that. Yeah, I was very surprised to see that. I think in Florida it was 10.
Interesting. So there's actually a code. Wow, I had no idea that yeah, got that official. I would think, you know, it's like just laying out the facts. So, I mean, when you started doing research into this topic and the two intersecting, I mean, tell me about some of the cases that you researched and how they did intersect, how it actually worked out in real world terms.
So, well, a lot of the cases that were conveyed to me were, hey, this happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm only telling you because I made a request out there. So I started to write the book, and it was based on actual cases, starting with the one I mentioned from when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Well, I was lucky enough to, I did a post, and I got in touch with a detective who the story is loosely based on,
mm-hmm,
who is long since retired, but he's like, look, I don't know if this stuff is real, but I'll tell you what happened to me. And he lived a very dark life, both figuratively and literally, and he had terrible things happen throughout most of his life, and the cases that he ran across just made it worse. And he cared so much for people, but he was constantly seeing them, you know, murdered and yeah, abused and things like that. So I put a post out and said, hey, I need to add some more stories and cases in here. And so the first responders came and said, okay, don't use my name. Don't, you know, I want to remain anonymous, mm-hmm, but here's what happened to me. And some of it was very simple, you know, crazy ghost stuff. And, you know, so I had to, you know, stretch it out a little bit for the story. And then some were very, very involved, but the response I got from these guys were, it was very therapeutic to speak it, because they didn't tell each other either. There wasn't any forum for them to say, you know, hey, you know, how was your day? Oh, I saw,
yeah,
tell me too. Let's talk about it. It didn't go down. And so I actually honor that, because I felt bad. How do you go home to your family and say, oh, it was a normal day when it wasn't?
Sure.
And in the second book, I actually have a counseling group that meets to say, hey, I'm a first responder and this is what happened to me. And, you know, it's sort of like an AA for them mm-hmm. and their paranormal strife that they deal with.
How interesting.
So I was lucky to get those. I was lucky to get those cases directly from the horse's mouth, so to speak. But again, everyone's like, hey, you know, thank you for letting me tell you. And then once they told me one, they're like, oh, wait a minute, something else happened. Mm-hmm. And I got another message. And I was like, okay, keep them coming.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying they all happened. I'm not saying they were all supernatural. They didn't have an explanation. And there was definitely a paranormal element to them.
Yeah.
So the very first one I got, oh, my gosh. I might have told this last time, but it still raises the hairs on my arm. But a young EMT had responded that a woman was not breathing in her apartment. And so when he showed up with his partner, they went to knock on the door, and the door was slightly open. And they opened it a little bit more and took one step in, and there was a woman standing to the left, and she had on a yellow robe with short brown hair. And she just pointed to the stairs to the right. And so they took it as, okay, you know, the victim must be upstairs. And so they went upstairs, and when they got there, it was the same woman in the yellow robe with the short brown hair lying dead on the ground, on the floor. And they went back to find the other woman, and they couldn't find her. And the woman lived alone. And to make it even more creepy, the call came from inside the house, and it was from a woman saying that this woman had died.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's a lot of cases like that where they were like, we found the woman dead, and that's what was written, was woman was unresponsive. They didn't know who called, but there wasn't any evidence of foul play.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no reason to say we need to find the individual that called, but the call came from inside the house, and neighbors swore the woman lived alone, didn't have any visitors that day that they saw, that sort of thing.
One would then go, okay, if it's a 911 call, would that voice be on tape somewhere?
You know, this was, I don't forget how many years ago. I would imagine so, but again, I'm not sure that story was conveyed and when they reported it. In other words, they reported, yes, the woman is unresponsive, but the caller was not there.
Sure.
And then they just, okay, well, there was no reason to follow up anymore. So he didn't share that with anyone that, you know, there was a woman standing there and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So there's no, and likely if there was no reason to save the tape, it's probably, you know, been taped over or lost at this point in time. Wow.
Yep.
Something that we see, you know, and this goes back to the Unsolved Mysteries days, when a lot of this stuff was kind of introduced to the general public in the 80s of like, hey, this actually happens this way or that way. I remember seeing many cases where psychics, mediums would be used on actual investigations. How often does that actually happen, both officially or unofficially, within departments to help direct cases or help, you know, lead people to tangible evidence?
So I asked that question of the detective that I was, the retired detective, and he said more often than you would think, but he didn't quantify it for me, but he said that often the families of the people that were lost or missing, they almost always reached out. They did anything and everything. So your non-believers became believers overnight when they, because of the desperation of finding their loved one and finding out what happened to their loved one. So, but unfortunately he said that the ones that really could help and the ones that were the real deal were very much the exception and not the rule.
That'd be understandable. And
there's a business of fake psychics for that situation.
Are you serious?
It's sad.
Oh my God. I had no idea.
Yeah. And exactly. And it's kind of funny because I'm like you. I'm like, why didn't you go further? Why didn't you take that a step further, right? Why didn't you check the tape? Why didn't you, you know, talk to these people? And it's like, you got to remember, you and me, Tony, we're like, yes, we want more. The cops are like, I don't want any more. I didn't want any more. The family doesn't want any more. We want it to be over.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it's over and done with. And the last thing they want is some sort of supernatural element thrown in there or, you know, because even if you can say, okay, I think this happened, you still don't know. And it still remains a mystery, right? Because it's still supernatural and paranormal and true to its definition. It can't be explained by science. So they're, you know, there's not any closure in that for them.
Yeah, that makes sense. This is an interesting one. It's a question that I kind of ponder sometimes. And obviously, totally open-ended. In terms of people actually dying due to something paranormal, and that's—I don't think of it as like, oh, the big movie scene where a stake comes flying across the room and stabs somebody in the heart. More so indirect. More so, I guess, kind of passive aggressive, if you will, in terms of spirits. How often do you think that occurs, where maybe it's something that drives someone to kill themselves? Maybe it's just a gentle push down the stairs and no one was there, and it's just a, you know, it's deemed an accident. How often do you think that those sort of things occur, where the dead or spirits or whatever have an influence on actually killing the living?
You know, it's a great question, and you know, I'm an alien guy too, so we can kind of apply this to the aliens. Mm-hmm. You know, do they want to abduct us and kill us, or do they need us alive for their purposes? So you apply that question to the spirits on the other side. What do they need from us? And, you know, we talk about mischievous, you know, spirits, and then we talk about poltergeists, you know, that could actually, you know, seemingly try to harm us. Mm-hmm. So is it the fear that they feed on? And so they don't want us to die, they want us to live, but they want to keep scared? Mm-hmm. Or do they want to push us to the edge, like you said, nudge us, put thoughts in our head, you know, suicide, and push us over the edge so that you're on the other side? And now, and I've read a lot of books where, you know, a very strong entity is literally using other entities that have crossed over as their fuel, their battery, so mm-hmm. to speak, and they're trapped, they can't leave. And, you know, you see that a lot in haunted house stories, where there's one main strong, you know, entity, and then the others are sort of trapped there, and they kind of, you know, just follow his lead, or they're just there for, you know, the nourishment of the energy. So that's kind of my thought, is most of them probably need us to stick around, you know, to feed on the energy. But if they're strong enough and they can do it from the other side, then yeah. Or maybe pushing one over the edge to suicide, then the rest of the family gives them the nourishment of that grief. You know, I don't know. It depends on what their goal is, what their end game is, what do they need.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thing, because, I mean, if you watch enough Dateline, you can see the stories where it's, you know, very much a very twisted personality, probably a disorder of some sort, where the end game is to make the partner go mad or get basically, you know, preying on someone's depression or preying on someone's anxiety to the point of them actually harming themselves. And maybe even, you know, killing themselves, and then they can collect on a life insurance policy or something of that nature. The living do that at times. I guess if you're a ghost, you're not going to collect a life insurance policy. But if you're really, if you're vengeful, if you, you know, on the other side, if you're, I really believe, I'm guessing we're still pretty much us personality wise. I mean, I believe anyone can grow, probably even the dead. And move beyond that sort of, you know, archaic way of thinking. But if some don't, I mean, I wonder how often that happens, where they just, you know, they don't care. Like, I'm just going to make this person's life miserable because my life was miserable, and misery loves company.
You know, I think it goes either way, obviously, but it's an extreme either way. In other words, You get on the other side, and not to sound trite, but you see the light, mm-hmm. literally and figuratively, but you really understand what you did and the consequences of your actions, and you see them so objectively that must absolutely just crush you mm-hmm. to realize the pain you've inflicted on people. Even though you know it's unintentional, you still have to sort of own that for a moment. And either you own it and then go through the process of moving on and growing from it, or you completely shun it and say, I refuse to, you know, take responsibility and see myself as the bad person, and cling to the fear and anger that you had in life, and go the other route. And both of them, you know, I hope that you can, they're both rough to go through, mm-hmm. but, you know, the first one, obviously you can move on, and you'll see it as lessons, as, you know, you get higher perspective and that sort of thing. But it's very easy to keep going backwards into the darkness, and you just become worse and worse of what you are. And, you know, so when people say, you know, are ghosts aware of their surroundings? I think they're just aware of themselves and what's opportunic for them, mm-hmm. no matter where they are. And if they find it's sort of like a bug. If it finds a nice dark corner and there's food there, it's like, well, that's their home now, right?
Yeah. Because, like, a person in life who may have caused a lot of harm to people, you know, emotionally or mentally, and then suddenly they pass on and they're met with this reality, which they've been running from their entire life, from other people telling them or reminding them of the damage they've done. Maybe they know deep down, but I think some people at some point just they block it out. They're able to tell themselves that they are the victim and that they didn't do this. Is there that enlightening point when you're dead and you see the light? I mean, does it always, does it always actually make you move past that, monkey mind thinking of, I'm just, I'm only going to be, I'm not accountable for this and I'm going to react this way, more evolved thinking where I can absorb this. I can go admit their faults.
I think so. And again, it depends on the reasoning why. So you've got I'm not going to call them easy outs, but and again, assuming, karma is a thing and reincarnation is a thing, so I cross over and I look back and I treated you wrong. But then I realized that in another life, you did the same thing to me. And it wasn't so much payback, but I chose to do it to you so you can understand what you did to me and understand it's something you shouldn't do to anybody else.
Okay.
So you kind of look back and go, okay, that was, that was balancing karma, but he needed to understand that what he did was wrong because he did it and never understood it was wrong. But so I'll do it to him in the next life and then he'll get it. So you have that kind of easy fix there. But crossing over and looking back and realize, you inflicted pain and owning it and understanding, well, I did it, but I did it because I was treated poorly. And rather than step away from that behavior, I became part of that. So you figure, and a parent is an alcoholic, the kid becomes an alcoholic, but then one kid says, no, I can see this, I don't want to do this, I see the road they go down on, so I'm stepping away from it. Other people, they just get caught up in the cycle, they get caught up in the physical addiction as well that's attached to that, because I think the physical, the emotional, the spiritual, it's all together, and there is DNA, and I think the spiritual DNA especially, you get that in you from the parents, and you're part of the same soul family. I mean, I'm not saying you can't resist it and change, but you're predisposed to it, right? And so, and it almost feels right because it is part of who you are, so then it's even more difficult to not go down that road or release it.
If we're talking about reincarnation and the idea of a soul family, if one does come back, are we constantly, with the same group of people? Or is it the same, group that gets recycled over and over and over until there's some sort of higher consciousness? Or is it new families all the time and you're just kind of dropped wherever, in your opinion?
So my opinion, you have that core group and you've grown together, and there's another level of understanding and existence that happens, at least in my thought process of what I've read and what I understand and what I've gotten through channeling sessions, is it's not only do you come together after the life and totally get and understand the perspectives and the deeper understanding of everything, but you can overlay those experiences. So you will actually be able to absorb my experience, almost as if you had gone through the life yourself. So when you do that, now you're literally sharing energy. And yeah, I mean, why? And like attracts like, so you're just going to continue to stay together and continue those incarnations together.
Is it the same roles every time? Can it be like for example, say someone's grandparents died, and then a couple years later, they have a child. Could that child be the grandparent reincarnated, of that lineage? Or is that going to, does that come back in a different way? Is it always like, this is going to be your kid eternally? Or is it like in the next life, that's your aunt or something of that nature?
I think it falls to what the lesson is to be learned and who's best suited to play it. So if you've got someone who's had 1,000 incarnations, and 400 of them are a stern mother figure, and they're just really good at it, and there's a lot of lessons in that, and so you say, hey, I need a stern mother in this lifetime, I'm your spirit, so I think you just sort of develop into who would play the role best to make sure you get the experience you want. It's all about the experience. It's all about what you're trying to get out of this particular life, and who's going to help you, who's going to come in at the right time, nudge you one way, give you the right word. I believe that soulmates can literally have a moment in your life and they can spend the entire time with you. It just depends on what their role was in that particular incarnation.
But yeah, because it makes it interesting to think about too, because okay, so you get married to someone, or you have a relationship with someone that's lifelong, and you have a child or children together. But initially, these were two separate people in two different families. Does that merge you then together with that person if you create a human being with them? Are you all then part of that soul family, or is it still, you know, separated?
My understanding is that they're pretty much everybody's, the characters and the player are the same actors for the most part.
Okay.
So I think you borrow, but the thing is, it's sort of like if you bring somebody new into the group, you got to get them caught up, right? They have to know everything about you. So I imagine it's just more streamlined, you know, using that same group. Because everybody knows your background. They know what you're looking for. There's an instant understanding because you've all grown and merged together over hundreds, if not thousands, of lifetimes.
Have you heard of any stories or cases where it's very much that situation of family that there's the younger ones that have come into the group and they somehow have knowledge of a deceased family member that maybe some of the older members have knowledge of too, but never, you know, verbalized it to these newer, younger members?
I've read about them, Tony. I've never interviewed, you know, young children. Mm-hmm. I don't have children of my own. Years ago, my poor niece and nephew, when I was visiting over there, I think they were probably 4 or 5 and very young. And I said, is there anybody else in the room? I thought maybe they could see a ghost.
Yeah.
And they were like, no, Uncle Gare, who do you see? I'm like, never mind. So my first and only attempt was a fail. So I've never interviewed kids in that respect. But I do believe that birthmarks are absolutely tied to a trauma of the past. Now, whether or not it was a specific wound that took the life, or just a wound that impacted the life, or just happened in the life.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, birthmarks are funny. They're just like, oh, they're just a birthmark. It's just something you get. It's like, no. If you haven't realized it now, everything that happens is a reason in nature. Sorry. Mm-hmm. There's something else to this. And there have been a lot of cases where kids were born with birthmarks and they recall who they were, and then they find out who they said they were in the last life, and that person had a wound right where their birthmark was. And I find that very interesting.
Interesting. So, like, are we going to see, it will be dead by then, like some, or maybe, okay, I'll ask this question first before I go to that one. In terms of timetable, you die, is it like, boom, you're back and you're reincarnated into this family again? Or is it there's a queue here of dead people and there's only so many babies that are being born at the moment?
So, two answers to that. One is you have to go through a process of understanding and rebuilding, and depending on what your life was like. Now, my understanding is when you're a spirit, when you're a soul, you are pure and amazing, and there's no such thing as hate, anger, guilt, grief. None of that exists. That's why they come here, to experience it. And could you just imagine the culture shock of someone who's never experienced those things? Mm-hmm. You know, and then coming here and going through what, you know, unfortunately, is our lives are like. You know, I mean, if they haven't gone through it before, it's like, well, why is everybody mean? I don't understand. Why did that person just hit me? I don't, you know, all those things that happen, and they go back. And so there's a period where it could be very traumatic. The soul has to regenerate and come out of it. And I just, yeah, I can't imagine that, you know. But there's an understanding that that's how you grow. You put yourself in situations that are unfamiliar, sometimes unkind, to grow. And they know more of themselves and, of course, appreciate the positive stuff for having gone through the negative stuff. I really want to write a book that says, it's titled, Life is Supposed to Suck. And I mean that in that if life didn't have any hardships, you took one off. Good for you.
Sure.
Because what did you learn? You know, how to take, you know, tell me what kind of wine it is, you know, by just sniffing it. It's like, okay, I'm not impressed with that.
Yeah.
You know, you got to go through the tough stuff. You got to learn the rough stuff. And I think that's what they go through.
When it comes to the idea of reincarnation, is it always just the people who come next? Is it always a recycled person, essentially, or do new souls, do new energies come into the mix around time? I mean, it would almost have to be that, considering the numbers of populations on the planet.
So it's funny. Someone asked me that years ago. They said, "Are there just a certain amount of souls, and they're already made, or do they get made all the time?" And I was stumped. I said, "That is an amazing question." And so the more research I did is souls are being created all the time, and there's literally a line to get into the human experience. So, but I've also researched that, you know, the human experience is one of billions. You know, there's so many other things, and it's not just bipedal. You know, they can be a flower, they can be a bug, they can be the wind, they can be anything on the planet. They can be dirt, you know, they can be energy, they can be so many different forms and things. So this is just one particular experience on Earth that souls go through, but there's so many more.
Do we get to choose our own adventure where it's, you know, I want to go back and I want to be a grasshopper? Or, you know, a person, whatever. I mean, is it a conscious choice, do you think? Or is it just, guess what? Here's what's open.
You know? Yeah. So, yeah, right. I'll take the teacher in Indiana. I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
My understanding is there's actually elevated spirits who have done, they're done, so to speak, having gone through the human experience, and they're going through other experiences, mm-hmm. but they get the human experience. They graduated, they did it all. And they're, so you go to them and they sort of map it out for you. Mm-hmm. And could you imagine coming in with a clean slate and you had one life on Earth, and we'll say it happened in 2022, right? Mm-hmm. And you went through all this in the next, you know, 80 years, and then you passed over. I mean, good God, you've got some cleaning, you got some work to do just from the one initial lifetime, right? Just everything. So, sure. It's kind of mapped out. And then from there, it just goes into the, okay, now let's address all these things. You learned this, but you didn't learn that. You handled that well, but you didn't even handle that. You ran from that.
Mm-hmm.
So now you got to do that again. So my understanding, there's the elders, so to speak, that have a higher perspective.
This is an interesting one. The term old soul, it gets thrown around, and it usually makes sense when people are saying someone is this or that. And it's like there's almost like that individual has a level of knowledge, or I often see it as caution half the time, where it's like they may have never experienced what they're about to go through, but they seem to have an instinctual knowledge of how to handle it better than someone else who would be going through that sort of new experience. This is just kind of a weird one, but we all have different IQs. There's high IQs, there's low IQs. Would you say that individuals who naturally have a higher IQ maybe have gone through life a handful of times versus someone who is just a lower IQ? Not talking a disability or anything of that nature, just, you know, they just how they operate. Is that a new soul where that hasn't, you know, doesn't have the instinctual programming that one who's gone around a few more times would have?
I think if you have a intellectual higher IQ, it's in the DNA. And I think you chose that family line with that DNA to have that intellect in that lifetime. But to your point, I think with the instinct, I think that comes from the soul. So if you were to label a soul old or new, I really do it the instinctual connection and even the emotional, because everybody can go to school and memorize dates and learn things in books, right? Most of the world can do that. To connect and manage our emotions with 8 billion people around us in our daily lives, a lot of us have some trouble with sure. those moments at times. And I think that was something. So if you can control your emotions well, and that you express them in a positive, healthy way and use them, and then I would say, okay, that person's been here a lot, because I'm a left brain guy. And I think that's a safeguard for me, because I can be very emotional. So I think I set that up to say, okay, look at it analytically before you look at it emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I did that, whether I did it subconsciously or if that was my plan coming into life, I don't know, but thank God it's there, because I would just fly off the handle, you know, at every little thing. So I will tell you, with respect to my level of emotion, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty young. For
yeah.
sure.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, is this something that we evolve with and start understanding better? Like, your next round, is it going to be, okay, I'm going to take the lessons here and apply them, because it's all subconscious. If this is going on, we're not sitting there going, well, I remember my last life, I really fucked that up, I better do better this round. You know, it's not like that. So, but we all have instincts and we have emotions, and that those kind of, sometimes we have no idea where they're coming from or why they're there, but it's just, it's makes us who we are, I guess. Are we always trying to improve as we go? Is there ever an end to this cycle where you're like, cool, I made it to the goal, and I'm going to hang out of the castle?
I think you get to the point where you, I can't imagine anybody getting there, but I guess at some point you've experienced everything, but you have a level of understanding that you no longer are growing from the experience. And I think, in a simple form, you apply it to third grade. Mm-hmm. You can take third grade 1,000 times. At some point, you're going to be like, look, there's nothing you can show me that I haven't learned. Right.
Yeah.
So you just have to get to that level. Of course, that's, way beyond third grade. So I think, eventually you get to that level. But then what do? Then you become a teacher. Right. So you may come back just to be the signpost for people.
OK.
Coming into their life and still creating a character for someone to work off of. Hey, man, sorry, you're going to have to learn losing a parent early. So I'm going to come back with you and I'm going to pass away when you're 6 years old. And this is your lesson this life.
Yeah. Or does it work like Scientology where, okay, you did third grade and you're already way up the ladder here, but we changed some of the text in third grade, so you got to go back to do that and pay another $699 as well. Is there truly an end to growing and learning? I don't know. It's just an interesting thought on the topic.
I'm not sure. I think for the human experience, I'm going to get all multiverse on you, but in this particular universe, yes. But what if there was the world was completely different? I mean, you go back to the storyline of, what if, Germany had won World War II? Now you're going to go back and experience that Earth in different lifetimes. And you got a whole new, study guide, right?
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Gare Allen. We got a lot more here. If you want to hear it, become a gravekeeper at patreon.com/thegravetalks. We're going to ask, can the dead reincarnate in a place other than our own planet? If we are reincarnated, do we have a choice if we want to be a ghost, or do we just cycle into the next thing? Can a soul ever die and not reincarnate? And what was the sign that Gary received from the other side that his mother was okay after death? Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.